Hey everyone, Ellie here. Up Against the Mob is my new cafe podcast. We're pleased to offer this exclusive bonus just for Cafe Insiders with me in conversation with my co-host from the Third Degree podcast, Safina Mekwai.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to discuss episode 5 of Up Against the Mob. Today, we are talking about Ellie's interview with Maria Konnikova. This episode was so fascinating, and I'm so excited to discuss, Ellie.
So I don't want you, Safina, to get any ideas from Maria, because I did after this interview, because she has done so many things and has such a fascinating career. I mean, she's got all these degrees in psychology. She's this accomplished writer. She's written bestsellers. She writes for The New Yorker and all these other outlets. And on top of that all, she's this championship poker player.
I have so many more questions about the poker, but I feel like she sounds like the kind of person who kept a list of like all the jobs she wanted to do and then just ticked off all of them as she went and did them.
Exactly.
But it also sounds like she was in school for a very long time, and having just finished school, I'm so ready to not do that again.
Yes, good lesson. You're in the real world now. Let's run with it.
Well, speaking of the real world, I thought we could start off by talking about a really fascinating part of this episode in which you discuss mob rules and the mob code. And you mentioned that those rules and mob code are broken whenever it's convenient for the mob. Can you give us any examples of that?
Yeah, so it's kind of like the old, you know, no honor among thieves thing. But when these guys get formally sworn in, right? And I guess this has been shown in movies or TV somewhere, although I can't think of a great example off the top of my head. But it really is theatrical the way they do it, because we've had testimony about this from many, many cooperators over the years. They take these guys to a secret location, undisclosed until the last minute. They have these guys get dressed up for the occasion in nice suits. They bring them into a room where a whole bunch of maid guys are there. It's like a fraternity or sorority initiation, really.
I was in a sorority, so it's really resonating all of a sudden.
Anyone who's been through that can probably visualize this. They prick their fingers, like that actually happens. They give them a picture of a saint, and then they burn the picture of the saint in their hands and make them repeat, if I should ever betray my oath, I should burn in hell like the picture of this saint. And then they inform them of the mafia rules. Now, it's so interesting to see these rules, to hear about them, because there are some that everyone agrees on, and then there are others that are kind of like very, you know, family to family or region to region by region. I guess it's like our court system where there's like certain principles that we all agree on, but then you have sort of circuit by circuit variations in some of the nuance. But let me sort of run through what they are. The number one rule, of course, is omerta, silence, right? You can't rat, you can't ever talk. But even that has variations. Like some families think you're breaking the oath if you plead guilty. Even if you don't admit, yes, I was a member of the Genovese family, just by going into court and saying, I admit I committed this crime, old school guys will say that violates the rules. Newer, more modern guys are like, yeah, you can plead guilty. I mean, let's get real here. You know, sometimes you have to cut a deal. Here's some other big ones that I've always seen observed. You don't mess with a judge. You don't mess with a prosecutor. You don't threaten them. You don't try to, you know, harm them. And that's a business rule because it's bad for business. The worst thing these guys want is to draw law enforcement attention to themselves. No better way to do that than to mess with a judge or a prosecutor. And by the way, it doesn't help you. It doesn't make your case go away. It just makes it 100 times worse. So I know there's some instances from the 70s where that was done, but really in the last at least 2 decades, that has not happened in the mafia, and I think before that. Then you get into some, what I will classify as the oft-violated rules. One of them is that you don't mess with another guy's wife, maybe, you know, depending who you're talking to, maybe sister, maybe daughter, maybe, I guess, mother. I've never heard of that one. But in a you know, sexual, romantic way. And of course, there are many, many tales of just that happening. And the number one rule that is violated constantly, in my experience, is this prohibition on drug dealing. And this goes back a long ways. And it's funny, right? Because they're all crooks. That they're criminals. They're murderers. They're extortionists. They're robbers. But they say, well, but we don't do drugs. Now, why is that? This goes back to the sort of early days of the mob, when it was really a notion rooted in racism. And the mob has a lot of problems. Virulent racism is among them. But they saw drugs as not something that we dignified mafiosos do. That's for minorities, that's for Black gangs in the city. And again, this is according to various cooperators over the years, and that's where this prohibition came from. And we don't do that stuff. I've also heard other versions from cooperators, and they could both be true, that this really came about when the drug laws got ratcheted up, especially in the 70s and 80s. And they made the decision that, you know, there's way too much risk and downside if you get caught with, you know, whatever amount of heroin, you could go away. You know, when these draconian drug laws started passing, again, cost-benefit business decision, it's not worth it. The thing is, they all do it, or virtually all do it, right? You know, Michael Visconti talks about that in one of the earlier episodes, that a lot of these guys who preach it do it. They sell heroin. There's just too much money in it. There's too much temptation for it. They're too close to it being in the criminal world. And I had cases, and again, I think I referenced this in the Visconti episode. I had a case, one that I remember in particular, where we charged a guy with a whole bunch of racketeering offenses. And probably the least serious was he was involved in the marijuana trade. And he absolutely refused to plead to that. We made him plead to it eventually, but he was willing to plead to extortions and robberies and assaults, but not the drug, but we did get him to plead to it. So they do have these set of rules, but they are often honored in the breach.
That's interesting. And I think it's interesting that Maria pointed out that sometimes it's the fact that the mob does have these rules and these codes that make people feel like there's a certain level of honor or organization with them that they're more comfortable with. But of course, you know, when push comes to shove, or when something seems fun or like they'll make a lot of money from it, they'll be willing to break those rules.
Yeah, I would definitely emphasize the latter of those, right? If it's profitable, they'll break it. Yeah, it's a facade. And the guys who have cooperated now, it's interesting. I had one cooperator in particular. He once said to me, you know, looking back on it all, it was so silly. Like we played these games and we played dress up and we pretended we had these rules and it was so just dumb on a base level. And I thought it was so interesting to hear him reflect that way. So yeah, they put up this thing like they have their rules, but really they're just open to whatever's convenient and profitable at the moment.
Ellie, that makes me wonder, in the scope of people who get dressed up and have rules and a code, if there are rules that prosecutors follow, and of course lawyers have. was that too much of an intro there?
No, we get dressed up. That's fair.
Well, I'm wondering, you know, there's obviously an ethics code, and I took an ethics class in law school, but I'm wondering if there are kind of rules or a code in the prosecutor's office.
Oh my gosh, there's so many. I mean, the subheading of my book is how Bill Barr broke the prosecutor's code, but I talk about that. So yeah, I mean, look, there's the written rules and there's any number of written rules. There's the statutes, there's the ethics rules, you know, all of that stuff. But absolutely there are cultural rules that are unwritten that we all learn to understand. Some of them are very important, right? Like one of them that I write about a bit in the book is what we call the podium privilege, that once a prosecutor has gone into the well of the courtroom, stood at the podium and made an argument in the heat of battle, you don't second guess that person, right? You don't Monday morning quarterback that person, because we've all been there. We've all been in that experience, and we respect the person who's on the battlefield or on the playing field, so to speak. That's, I think, one of the sort of more important unwritten codes. And if you ever say, hey, I saw so-and-so's closing argument, it was pretty crappy, you'll get responded to like, come on, like, look, that's her closing argument. That's his closing argument. You know what I mean? Like, you'll get sort of put in place for that. And then we have a million silly little ones. I write in the book about, speaking of dressing up, how I got basically yelled at by my first supervisor, because for my first day of trial, I showed up wearing dress shoes, but they had no laces. They were like slip-on loafers. He was like, what are you doing? What the hell are you wearing? You know, we don't dress that way. No, I mean, there was actually like a lot more debate than there should have been about whether it was ever okay for a guy to wear a non-white shirt, like a light blue shirt, ever, or in front of a jury. So we had all sorts of rules like that too. And I guess not to the same extent as mobsters, but you know, a rule's only a rule until it no longer needs to be a rule, I guess.
Yeah. And I imagine that those are shifting and changing and maybe even culturally different depending on the prosecutor's office you're in or the court system or sort of the broader context in which the office sits.
Yeah. I mean, like any organization, prosecutor's offices and the mob, really, I'm not equating us necessarily, but there is such thing as organizational culture. And that changes over time. And Maria talked about that, how a lot of the mores and beliefs and expectations within the mob and of others outside the mob have changed significantly over time.
One part of the organizational culture that was interesting to me is your conversation with Maria about the wives and the girlfriends and the people that sort of surround the mob and how they often reap the benefits of the lifestyle, but, you know, the question of whether they were accomplices or aiders and abettors or if they even knew what was going on. So she talks about this sort of under the heading of cognitive dissonance, where something that you believe about a person or an organization doesn't match up to your perception of reality. And I'm wondering if you felt that in your work as a prosecutor with the mob.
You know, I had the blessing. One of the nice things about being a prosecutor is a lot of the moral lines are pretty straightforward, right? I never felt like what we were doing was cynical or dishonest. To the contrary, I felt like we were always honest and righteous in what we did. The phenomenon of the mob wife is so fascinating to me. And by the way, long before the TV show, Mob Wives, and separate and apart from that, Marie and I talk about, like, of course they know. They're smart people. They're not, how can you not know when your husband's not really working a job and claims he's in consulting or construction or whatever, and you have all this money coming in and he's going out at night? I mean, of course they know. And I think the wives were really more complicit than we were ever able to fully address through the law. I mean, it was very, very rare that we charged a wife. I mean, I don't think I charged one or two women, but not in their capacity as wives of mobsters, just as their independent capacity as doing business with the mob. And really, if I drill down to the sort of, the nuts and bolts of it, I probably could have charged a lot of mob wives because a lot of times they were directly part of the money aspect of it in particular, right? The laundering of the money, the accounts were all in the wife's name, the cars were in the aunt's name or the uncle, not the uncle's name, you know, he's usually. But, a lot of the women knew about this and were complicit in it. And there's a great recording we made of Angelo Prisco, the guy who Michael Visconti talks about in the first episode. And Angelo is complaining about his wife in the recording. And he says something to the effect of, she complains to me, oh, you're mafia. I told her, you knew this when we got married. You can't complain about it now. The best portrayal of that, the most lifelike portrayal of that I've ever seen is the actress who plays Carmela in The Sopranos, Tony Soprano's wife, Edie Falco. Yeah, I've met her actually at a green room once in CNN, and she's wonderful. Her performance is perfect because to me, that's so accurate because she fully understands what's going on and at times even uses it to her own advantage to sort of get her way with certain people, right? There's a scene where she sort of threatens like the school headmaster or something. That was very realistic to me. And that's consistent with what I know to be the real world mob wives.
It seems to me like it's both this kind of dissonance and also like a rationalization, like you reap the benefits and also, you know, you talk about in the episodes throughout the podcast that the folks in the mob felt like they were working hard, that this was kind of a job and that they were entitled to some of the benefits from it. So I wonder if it's both a dissonance about not believing, but also just rationalizing the means that produce the ends that some of these folks get so comfortable with.
I do wonder, man, I have to get one of these mob wives on the podcast. I can't think of one. I would have to be the wife of a cooperator or something like that. But yeah, I mean, I think there's an element of rationalizing. But look, the wives, let's just put it straight, like they put up with a lot of crap. I mean, I don't feel sympathy because they know what they're doing, but like these husbands are not good husbands. I mean, they cheat on the wives all the time. That is not every one of them, but by and large, in my experience, true. You know, they have this constant uncertainty. There's got to be an element of fear. Is something going to happen to the husband? Is something going to happen to me? By the way, I should note, on the topic of mob rules, that's one that is almost religiously observed. You don't go after, and I don't mean in a romantic way, I mean like in a violent or vengeful way. You don't go after wives, children, families, right? You don't. So if someone flips, you know, there are very high profile cooperators out there and their families still live right where they did before and no one's ever gone after those families. So that's one rule that they really do actually follow.
Well, moving from the wives to the mobster themselves, you asked Maria how she got interested in the mind of a criminal. And I wanted to ask you the same question. What made you want to become a lawyer or be a prosecutor? Was it about the criminal? Was it about the victim? What was it?
Yeah, I think it was a fascination with the human drama of it all, right? The part of it certainly was wanting to help victims and defend victims and stand up for them. And certain part of it was just the sort of old school, you got to wear the white hat and go after bad guys. But the bonus, or more than the bonus, really one of the inspirational factors for me was, where else do you see human drama on such open, raw display as this, right? You have people in their, at their worst a lot of times, in their most desperate moments, making these pivotal decisions like, do I flip? Coming to grips with the sort of reality of these sometimes dual lives that they're living and that people around them are living. And it sort of satisfies the amateur psychologist in me. I think I've said before publicly, but when I went into college, I wanted to be a psychology major. And I took Psych 101, and for whatever reason, the class was really dull and boring, and I got away from it. But the next stop for me on the professional scale was lawyer and prosecutor, and I guess it satisfies that psychological itch a little bit.
Definitely. And I think that's probably why so many people are excited about stories like the ones you're telling with this podcast, with shows and with TV about the mob. It's all human stories.
Exactly. I mean, that's when it's the most relatable, right? I mean, I think the reason people related in particular to The Sopranos was because, you know, The Godfather feels and felt like theatrical, right? In the way it was presented. But The Sopranos, you see him, you know, trying to get his daughter into college, and you see him, you know, going to Starbucks and being like confused by that they don't take cash, you know, like it drives home that this is real. And these people are among us and have to deal with, in some respects, you know, the same worries and concerns that any person, any working person, any family person has. And I think that also resonated with me in making the decision to go into this field.
Episode, you talk a little bit about psychological distance and that in some ways we glorify crimes or criminals that feel psychologically distant. And I wondered, with the mob in particular, there's both the distance because people can separate the mob, but there's also just so many media portrayals about the mob. And I wondered if you felt psychologically distant as a civilian from the mob, and how you thought that juries related to the mob.
You know, it's such an interesting question. It's something I really struggled with. I guess at first felt a bit of distance, like a bit of awe, like, I can't believe this is real. But when I got to know this business so well, that distance disappeared, right? I mean, I got to know what these people were like. I spent my working days with them or dealing with them. So it became real to me. But the distance was a real challenge when it came to juries. And we talk about this a bit in the episode, because it's so easy for a jury to hear about these crimes and think, that doesn't affect me. That's a handful of blocks in certain neighborhoods of Queens or Bensonhurst, Brooklyn, or whatever. And as long as you're not involved with them, it's not a threat to me. What do I care, right? It's like, it could almost feel theatrical to a jury. It could almost feel like something they were watching on a TV, and hence less real and less immediate. And as prosecutors, we didn't want that. We wanted it to feel real and immediate and threatening and dangerous. You would struggle with that. And there was even such a phenomenon. It sort of depended on the individual defendant, but some defendants could be quite charming to a jury. Now, a jury would never hear them talk. No mobster ever takes the stand. I never had a mobster take the stand. But we would play recordings for the jury. And some mobsters are really interesting and fascinating to listen to. And there were instances where I could see the jury, oh my gosh, the jury is really, I talk about it in the episode with Maria, right? The Ciro Perone case. I think the jury loves this guy, you know? And we fixed that in the retrial, where we didn't play those sort of charming, funny tapes of him. So you have to be cognizant of that. I mean, you know, as Maria and I talk about, like, where else are you watching a movie or watching anything unfold and think, I'm rooting for the bad guy. Oh my goodness. Like, I really want the bad guy to prevail here. So it is something that's unique to the mob and the psychology there. I think Mario does a really good job delving into it.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. And I think it helps, just as like a viewer or consumer of some of this stuff, unpack why we root for the anti-hero in this way. And maybe it's a good reminder to check when we're doing that just because somebody feels sort of psychologically distant.
Yeah, I mean, look, to me, it's fine when you're watching a movie or even, you know, or Breaking Bad or The Wire, like, enjoy. You know, and I don't want to be a spoil sport and say, like, you should be wagging your finger at Bryan Cranston's character in Breaking Bad and you should condemn, you know, Omar and all those guys in The Wire. No, I mean, enjoy. But yes, in real life, I do think, you know, it helps to sort of take a step back, clarify, remember, whether, you know, obviously if you're involved in these cases, but even not, you know, there is such thing as being the good guy and the bad guy. There is such thing as right and wrong, not to oversimplify, but I think it's healthy to be aware of that sort of dissonance and distancing that Maria discussed.
Well, I thought we could end on, I heard that there was a part of this interview about Maria learning to play poker.
So Maria, as she said, is fascinated with human psychology and in particular sort of deviant human psychology, criminal human psychology. And she was drawn to the world of poker because I think as she explains in her book, there's a lot to learn there about human psychology and errors we make and assumptions we make that are incorrect. So just to wrap up, I want to come back a little bit to poker here, because you have this interest in this deep study of the criminal mind and the con game mind and the mobster's mind. What motivated you to learn and pursue professional, not recreational, not friend games, professional poker?
Well, at the beginning, I had no idea I was going to be pursuing professional poker. I just started on this journey, actually, as a way of exploring luck and the role that luck plays in your life. I knew that that's what I wanted my next book to be about. How can we kind of learn the difference between skill and chance, between what we can control and what we can't? And I was not a poker player. I was not someone who cared about the game. But I came across John von Neumann's theory of games, which is the foundational text of game theory, and read that von Neumann was not only a poker player, but poker was actually the inspiration, the model for game theory. That here he was kind of modeling the most complex strategic decisions of the 20th century. And I actually mean that literally. The guy was advising the U.S. government. He was, you know, one of the people who made the hydrogen bomb.
pretty big stakes, yeah.
Yep, exactly. And here's this guy who says, poker is the key to this. If I can solve poker, I can figure out how to model these incredibly complex human interactions, because poker is a very good model for life because it's a game of incomplete information, which is what life is. And I was like, oh, this is really interesting. Let me kind of read a little bit more about this. And I decided actually, as I started reading, that this was the book that I wanted to immerse myself in this world, learn how to play, find a coach, you know, who would be kind of my mentor. Ended up teaming up with Eric Seidel, who's one of the best players in the world. And, you know, I had no idea if I'd be good or not. Like I said, I was not a poker player at all. And the journey took on a life of its own. You know, with exactly a year after I first started playing, I won a major international title. I became a sponsored pro. It became a very different journey, but I did learn a lot about the role of chance.
You set out to study chance and luck, but by the end, and there's a legal debate about this in the gambling cases, is poker a game of luck or skill?
Oh, it's 100% a game of skill. Ah. I mean, I can tell you why in one sentence. I can win with the worst hand. I can lose with the best hand. That's it. Period. End of story. But I actually don't understand why. I think it's political. I think it was because there was a very strong political lobby against online poker by some live poker operators. I'm not going to name names, Sheldon Adelson. But I think that there was a lot of money behind that, because to me, it's so clear. No other game in a casino is that true. You need to have the best hand to win. Blackjack, anything. If you don't have the best hand, you're losing. Poker, that's just simply not true. I can have the best hand and lose. That, to me, is the only argument you need.
Yeah. One last question for you. As somebody who is a mediocre to poor home game player, give me one piece of poker advice.
I will give you the piece of advice that Eric Seidel gave me when I was just starting out. Learn to pay attention. Actually, pay attention. Really pay attention to the people you're playing with. Watch what they're doing. and note it down. Figure out, you know, how aggressive is this person? What's their strategy? Every single time there's a showdown where you actually see people's cards, write it down. And then go back and see how do they play it on every single street. And actually do that over and over and over.
Great advice. Now I'm going to start running my friends off the table with that. Thank you.
Well, I would not play poker with Maria, but I would totally challenge you to a game of poker if you, like me, also play very rarely.
All right. Yeah. I played the other day with one of my best friends growing up who I've played with for years, not in any kind of competitive setting, and his two sons and my one son. And the final two of the five were two of our sons who just cleaned us out and bullied us all around the table and bluffed us and really made us look like sorry old men.
Okay, we are not inviting your son to our poker game then. No way.
Yeah, no, keep them out. They're sharks.
Well, thanks so much, Ellie. That's it for episode 5, and we will see you on the next bonus episode.
That's it for this episode of Up Against the Mob. If you like what you heard, please rate and review the show on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. Every positive review helps new listeners to find the show. And as always, please send us your thoughts or questions to letters@cafe.com. Up Against the Mob is presented by Cafe and the Vox Media Podcast Network. I'm your host, Ellie Honig. The executive producer is Tamara Sepper. The senior producer is Adam Waller. The technical director is David Tadashur. Music is by Nat Wiener. The Cafe team is Matt Billy, David Kurlander, Sam Ozerstaten, Noah Azulai, and Jake Kaplan. Special thanks to Nate White for his help with research. And special thanks to my interviewer, Safina Mekli. I'm Ellie Honig, and this is Up Against the Mob.